This is the Monday, April 4th, 2016 episode of The History Author Show. Visit our iHeartRadio channel or subscribe on iTunes to enjoy a brand new interview every Monday morning, as well as Classical Wisdom Wednesdays and History in 5 Fridays.
Oh, New York ain't New York anymore. How I miss those old pals of mine. The sawdust is gone from the floor where we harmonize, sweet Adeline. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore.
Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Dean Karyanis, and this is the History Author Show on iHeartRadio. Today, we're strapping into our time machine and heading back to the very earliest days of America's Republic. Our guest is accomplished author Fergus Borderwick, and his book is The First Congress, How James Madison, George Washington, and a Group of Extraordinary Men Invented the Government. It's the untold story of what was, by necessity, the most productive Congress in U.S. history, sitting in session from 1789 to 1791. Mr. Borderwick is the author of 6 previous books. They include America's Great Debate, Henry Clay, Stephen A. Douglas, and the Compromise That Preserved the Union, Washington, The Making of the American Capital, and Bound for Canaan, The Underground Railroad and the War for the Soul of America. You can learn more about these and his other titles at FergusBorderwick.com. Okay, now that this session has been called to order, let's travel back in time to the very first Congress, 225 years ago, in Lower Manhattan. I'm joined on the line by Fergus Borderwick, author of The First Congress, How James Madison, George Washington, and a Group of Extraordinary Men Invented the Government. Thank you for making the time to talk with the History Author Show today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here, Dean.
I have been looking forward to speaking with you since I picked up this book quite a while ago, since I got the review copy. Part of the founding that we overlook is the messy work here of legislation, of the sort of horse trading. We look at the presidents, we look at the great military figures, we look at Alexander Hamilton, we look at that first cabinet of Washington, but we've overlooked the Congress, the legislators. Maybe we recognize their name from one of the local streets in New York City or northern New Jersey or wherever you happen to be from, but we didn't get to know them, and yet you write and make the case that the first Congress was the most important in U.S. history, and it faced so many challenges. It's almost absurd. As I began reading the first Congress, I said, oh gosh, they wouldn't know any of these things. Well, nothing was settled. Not that they didn't know them. They hadn't planned them out yet. And they had none of the big staffs that we have today that we just take for granted for congressmen. Titles, where to meet, the size of the districts, the rules that would govern the body. They only had a ghost of a government, as you call it. So tell us, what were those early legislative days like in 1789, 1790, 1791?
Well, to put it in perspective, let me say this. I think our way of thinking about power in the federal government today has been shaped almost entirely by the way the presidency has evolved into a very powerful or even dominant office, beginning really in the 1930s with Franklin Roosevelt. That was not the case for the first century and a half, almost, of the nation's history. In those early years, in those early generations, as a matter of fact, Congress was the nexus or the locus, you could say, of power, not the presidency. The great decisions were made in Congress, not in the president's mansion. There are 2 exceptions to that. That's to say Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln, but they come much later. So in those early days, don't imagine that George Washington came into office with an agenda, a plan for his first 100 days, which is a rather unfortunate expectation that's been hung like a noose around the necks of presidents ever since Franklin Roosevelt first proclaimed that he would try to accomplish so much in 100 days. So at any rate, when we're looking at Congress, we're looking at the major power center of the government. Congress is inventing government as it goes along. The Constitution was just a piece of paper, a great piece of paper, but a piece of paper nonetheless. So it's the members of the House and the Senate who are inventing what Patrick Henry called the crazy machine of government. So what were those days like? Well, nobody knew whether it was all going to work. Members of Congress were filled with trepidation. They didn't even really know whether people who'd been elected to the first Congress were going to show up.
I love that.
When you read their letters, they often express anxiety and even fear that there won't be enough people there to make the government. And John Adams, the vice president who presides over the Senate, predicts that 50% of those members won't even finish out their terms. They'll leave before the end. So the anxiety is tremendous. Nobody knows if the ship of state is going to float or not. What were their lives like as members of Congress? They were mostly prodigiously hardworking. Some weren't. Some, one suspects, spent rather too much time in the local taverns or maybe in the red light district over there by the East River. But the bulk of them were very, very able men, some of them brilliant, like Madison. Others, not brilliant, but tremendously committed to making government work. They work 6 days a week. They meet for several hours every day. In the evenings, they have committee meetings. Some of them are members of as many as 70 committees. Now,
wow.
These are small committees, and they're not meeting all the time. But just imagine how great a commitment this is on the part of members to set themselves such an enormous workload. They're figuring out everything as they go along.
You were speaking about the presidency and the role of the president. And I thought how you describe a few places in the first Congress, how Washington is leading, but quietly. He's not going and hectoring these legislators. He's not trying to tell them what to do. I believe it's maybe a European observer who's noticing this about Washington. And you say that Washington would have very much liked to have been remembered this way for how he sort of lays things out without pushing anybody or without saying it's his agenda for things. And the push and pull of Congress and the executive, we see that a few times. You mentioned Jackson and Lincoln. Then after the Civil War, we get into the Gilded Age. We're switching a lot of presidents. It pulls back very much the other way, where people begin to say, well, the president walks the street alone. People think it's crazy. I mean, William McKinley has one guard at the White House. It just seems inconceivable today. So if you take those steps back to the time you're speaking about, you get to the point where there are no whips. There's no majority leader, no minority leader, not a speaker of the House. But one of the men who you mentioned that does take the lead is James Madison. What was his role in creating the government? And George Washington is the other man in the dust jacket. How do they work together there, Washington leading and Madison doing the work here?
Well, I'd turn that around a bit, Dean. I would say that Madison is more often doing the leading and Washington is letting him lead. Washington is not a very directive figure at the time of the first Congress. Washington is, to his bones, a Republican. That's a small r Republican. He believes in Republican government. He believes that Congress is the leading edge of government and that it's the president's job to execute the executive branch, to execute what Congress decides. Now, that said, Washington has views. He plays them pretty close to his vest. The one area in which he really does make his desires pretty clear, not to Congress, but through Madison, is on the location of the federal capital, the national capital. We'll talk about that a bit later, perhaps. Washington and Madison are close. Madison is as close to a friend as Washington probably had. Protégé is probably more accurate. Washington was a cold man. He was charismatic, magnetic. People, members of Congress and the public, were interested in what Washington wanted, though he rarely expressed that in so many words. And I think Madison had a great knack for reading Washington's mind. But Washington deferred to Madison. Madison was, after all, the author of much of the Constitution. Madison was a brilliant parliamentarian. Washington was not. He was a different kind of leader, a unifying figure for the nation. But the strategy that was pursued during the first Congress, especially at the beginning, was largely Madison's. He was Sometimes it said that he acted as he filled the role of a prime minister for Washington, but more precisely, he crafted the role of floor leader. That's to say, he managed legislation in that first and much of the second session, deciding what was going to come up, and had a great influence on the appointing of men to committees. Madison and Washington conferred almost every day. They didn't leave notes, unfortunately. One would love to have been a fly on the wall in the president's mansion while Madison was there filling him in on the day's doings in Congress. Another area that required a great deal of creative politics in the first Congress was the crafting of the First Amendments, which we now call the Bill of Rights. Nobody then called them the Bill of Rights. That's a much, much later term. There were more than 200 proposed amendments. Madison took on the role of cutting those 200 down to a manageable number. Many of them were overlapping, but most of them had been proposed by anti-federalists, that's to say the enemies of the Constitution, people who wanted to undo the government created by the Constitution. Madison was at that point a strong supporter of amendments. He started out as an enemy of amendments. Then he ran for Congress in an anti-federalist district in Virginia. And during that campaign for his seat, he said, well, in fact, he'd always supported amendments all along, which wasn't actually true, but it did help him get elected. And then once in office, he said, well, he didn't really support most of those amendments anyway. In today's terms, most people, most commentators anyway, would probably condemn Madison as a flip-flopper, having been against amendments before he was for them, before he was against them again. But where did Washington come down on amendments? Washington, a strong Federalist, that's to say a believer in strong central government, did not particularly like the idea. He and Madison, however, came to believe that it was necessary to mollify anti-federalists to some degree and to give them some amendments. And Washington had made it clear very subtly in his inaugural address in 1789 that he would not disapprove of amendments which did not undermine the government. Madison actually wrote much of that inaugural address. So again, I think it's Madison who's driving the carriage here and Washington is riding in it, but they were in agreement. I should say, since we're on the subject of amendments, that nobody in the first Congress thought that either the Constitution as a document or amendments were sacred. Certainly didn't view amendments as the great towering pillar, this majestic pillar of the Constitution, as we, with good reason, see them today. Federalists like Madison and Washington and others really saw this as an experiment. They saw the Constitution itself as an experiment. Had they believed that it shouldn't be changed ever, they wouldn't have provided for amendments. So I think both Washington and Madison and their allies would have found today's notion of originalism, today's philosophy of legal or judicial originalism, strange and inexplicable, because they certainly didn't think they had created an inflexible document then.
You write in the first Congress about how Americans, they only notionally regarded themselves as a single people, is your phrase. So how did this group avoid the paralysis of the Continental Congress that preceded it and accept the fact that, okay, if you got an amendment that you didn't like or get a part of the Constitution, that you could come back later and change it? How did they keep this Congress from just melting away? As you said, some of them might not even have shown up. I could see some of them saying, well, forget it. I'm not even going to go because I don't want there to be a quorum, or I don't want this to be passed. I want to protect my state more than this federal government. So how did these extraordinary men overcome those?
Well, that's a very good question. How did they overcome sectionalism or their loyalty to special interests? And the first Congress didn't do any of its work with a collective group hug or singing a 1789 version of Kumbaya. Yeah. Picture the founders here, even little James Madison and others. He was little. He was only about 5'1" and not very healthy. But nonetheless, picture him and other members with their ruffed sleeves rolled up, their jackets off, their wigs thrown down on the floor and kind of duking it out here in Federal Hall, which stood on Wall Street in New York City. There certainly were sectional forces that were pulling members away from a consensus on many issues. There were major battles over the creation of the federal court system, over Alexander Hamilton's financial plan, over the location of the federal capital, and many other subjects. What enabled them? What engine was it that was driving them, however, to come to agreement, come to consensus, pushing them to compromise and to make the government work? In great part, it was fear of failure. The Articles of Confederation, which had held sway for the previous several years, were a failure. Everybody knew that they had failed. Under the Articles of Confederation, Congress was more like a committee with no chairman than it was a strong central government. And the members of the first Congress were afraid that if they failed, the entire country would fragment into any number of parts. Remember, you have 13 different states. And in fact, when Congress met in 1789, there were really only 11. North Carolina and Rhode Island had not ratified the Constitution and were resisting it. Rhode Island with particular tenacity, so much so that it became a problem for Congress. And there was open discussion of sending troops to the border of Rhode Island, marching in and bringing about what we today rather delicately call regime change in Providence and installing a state government more friendly to the nation. So anxieties and dangers like this are everywhere. There were fears that if the United States failed to pull itself together and become stronger, that the British might peel off parts of the country again. The British were still very powerful in Canada and were occupying certain forts that were technically American. The Spanish were a kind of menace, territorial menace from the Mississippi Valley. Southerners even threatened secession, even in 1789 and 1790. If this new central government dared to tamper with slavery, New England had its own interests, and many New Englanders, many Pennsylvanians, many Southerners talked about people from other states as if they were foreigners. The language that was used is sometimes shocking. We think of Pennsylvania and New York, they're neighboring states. But representatives from Pennsylvania said, what do we have in common with the Yorkers? Who were they to us? New Englanders are really the most extreme of all on that score. So what made these men extraordinary and remarkable was not that they were so unlike us or so unlike the members of Congress today, but that they reached deep into themselves and they achieved extraordinary things because they were desperate and they didn't dare to fail.
I'm glad you brought up the fear, because the fear of failure was something I was thinking about and included that in a couple of my questions. As I was preparing for this interview, I listened to your speech at the 2012 National Book Festival, and listeners can find that online if they'd like to listen to it. You were talking about a previous book. You described your experience falling in love with books as a small child in Yonkers, New York, just north of the city. You talk about climbing up the bookshelves, and sometimes you'd climb so high for a book that you'd have to call your mother to come and get you down. Then as I was reading the First Congress, I saw that as a metaphor for these representatives that are in there, and they're required to make this climb, and they have nobody that they can call to help bail them out. I wondered if that fear also acts as a unifying factor, and if it wasn't the fear, what was it that keeps this from falling apart as the Articles of Confederation did?
Well, besides the fear of failure, these men really wanted to make the machine work. There were anti-federalists, there were minority, and they were strident in the first Congress. Elbridge Gerry, the leading anti-federalist, he was a representative from Massachusetts, and he gives us the term gerrymandering. It should really be gerrymandering, that the term didn't come into use until some years later when he was governor of Massachusetts. Elbridge Gerry, a very active member of the first Congress, refused to sign the Constitution because he thought it was a lousy document. So there are anti-federalists who are very grudging. They're not happy with the new government. But yet, these are virtually all men who were what we today call, usually very unkindly, professional politicians. None of these were men who had left their plow in the field or torn off their shoemaker's leather apron to join Congress as amateurs. Virtually all of them had held office in towns, counties, cities, states, or had been members of one of the previous Congresses. These men were men with political experience. They were not all idealists. They were pragmatists, very pragmatic. There were very, very few zealots in the first Congress. After all, they just fought a revolution. What did they fight it for? They fought it in order to be able to do politics. They didn't fight the revolution to take politics out of government, the way some people in today's America imagine we'd be better off, but rather they fought a revolution to put politics into government. As residents of a colonial region under the British, they had not been allowed to do politics, or at least not very much. So they believed in politics as a solution to public problems. None of them thought the government or that the institutions of government that had just been created were the enemy. Nobody wanted to overthrow the government. I want to underscore this because I think that there are politicians in today's America and many members of the public who've been told for a generation that government is the problem. And I think they're often folks who, well-meaning, are very uninformed about why the founders created the government they did, why they created the institutions they did. And none of the founders, the members of the first Congress, imagined that government could be done without brutal compromises, competition, verbal slugfests, and very, very hard-won compromises. I think we have an idealized notion of compromise today, that it's a happy experience for everyone, and everyone goes away feeling that he got something good. By and large, in real compromises, most people go away feeling not so good at all because they didn't get everything they wanted. And if we really want to honor the founders, I think we need to go back and look at the realism and pragmatism with which they, one, created government and set out to make it work.
And gave us the amendment process, knowing that there were some things they wouldn't have dealt with, that they did, if not kick the can down the road, I guess would be the unkind way to put it, but also saying, here you go, kids, this is your legacy, and here are the tools. We're going to hand over the old jalopy to you, and you could start working on the car. We never got around to fixing that ping in the engine, so to speak. So they understood that it wasn't a complete and finished document at the time, and they gave us the tools with which to fix it and modify it and add a spoiler on it, to continue my car metaphor, which may or may not be working for people. But this group of extraordinary men that you mentioned in the subtitle, I want to put some names to those and just ask you to talk a little bit about them, because in your research, you lived with them. Roger Sherman, William McClay, James Jackson, Robert Morris, Oliver Ellsworth, and William Lawton Smith. Tell listeners a little bit about the new faces that they're meeting here in the first Congress and why they should take the time to read about more than just maybe the early presidents.
Sure. Congress was filled with interesting men, men who'd had unusual lives and had long governmental experience before they became members of the first Congress. Oliver Ellsworth of Connecticut, who has been unjustly forgotten, was a major power in the first Congress and at the Constitutional Convention. He was one of the most experienced members. He authored the judiciary bill that created the Supreme Court and the federal court system. It was an amazing accomplishment. It was observed by others, a sort of strategic ability to shed tears on the floor of Congress when something wasn't going his way, and maybe exercising a little emotional manipulation on his fellow members. Senator Robert Morris of Pennsylvania was a towering figure in his day, one of the major founders, and who had served as treasurer of the Continental Congress in the later years of the Revolutionary War. Morris was a large man in every sense, including his girth and his appetites and his ambition and his power. He had, in effect, saved the country single-handedly by pledging his own wealth as a guarantee against its debts at the end of the Revolutionary War. During the first Congress, he lobbied ardently to place the federal capital in Philadelphia or near Philadelphia. And although he failed, his machinations are absolutely fascinating to watch. And Morris later played a major role in attempting to develop the federal city in Washington, D.C., but that's a little outside the scope of this present book of mine. Senator William Clay, the other senator from Pennsylvania, is in many people's minds little more than a footnote in American history, but he did one thing which is of inestimable value. he left the only diary that was kept by a member of the Senate. Senators were in fact instructed not to keep personal records of the debates because the Senate's conclave was closed in those days. There were no observers, no visitors. So Senate records are extremely thin, except for McClay's wonderful diary, which is in print, by the way. And if you were to read my book or another major book about the first Congress, so that you had the background, I would recommend his diary to anybody. It's just called The Diary of William McClay. An extremely caustic, sarcastic individual. He was irascible. He was opinionated, which makes him a lot of fun to read. His thumbnail profiles of many of his colleagues, including James Madison, Robert Morris, and others, are, I don't want to overstate it by saying they're shockers, but he cuts everybody down to size. His diary is one of the few places where you really see the founders as human beings with frailties, foibles, shortcomings, and so on. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, we talked about a little bit earlier. Gerry was one of just a handful of individuals who went to the Constitutional Convention but declined to sign it because they didn't like it. Elbridge Gerry was the leader of the Anti-Federalists in the House of Representatives in the first Congress. Very, very interesting man, a deep-dyed patriot, deeply committed to the Revolution. He was a businessman from Boston, but he was what today we would call a states' rights man. And the Anti-Federalists are the progenitors of the states' rights movement. And those who fear or loathe a strong central government, he wanted more power restored to the states. And he debates vigorously throughout the first Congress on behalf of state powers and warns against a strong central government. By listening to Gerry, you understand that these arguments about states' rights have been there from the beginning. They never went away. Gerry's arguments are picked up by John C. Calhoun a generation or two later, and you hear them being, same arguments being made on the brink of the Civil War. And frankly, you hear them today from Tea Partiers, who ironically, when they proclaim their loyalty to the Constitution, are actually proclaiming their loyalty to the Anti-Federalists who opposed the Constitution. I mean, another man who deserves to be better known is Theodore Sedgwick of Massachusetts, who became, in effect, the floor manager for the radical financial program that was engineered by Alexander Hamilton, the Treasury Secretary. Sedgwick was what was called a High Federalist from Massachusetts, and one of the very, very few members of the first Congress who was knowledgeable about economics and finance. It's surprising how few members knew anything about that. That was one reason that Hamilton's plan faced such strong headwinds in Congress. But Sedgwick was a remarkably progressive man on other issues, say on slavery. He was the man who had lodged the lawsuit in Massachusetts, which ended slavery in the year 1780.
My guest is Fergus Bordewick, author of The First Congress, How James Madison, George Washington, and a Group of Extraordinary Men Invented the Government. Richard A. Baker, U.S. Senate historian emeritus, says, Bordewick brings back to life the practical, impatient, and tired politicians who transformed the parchment of the U.S. Constitution into the flesh and blood of a national government. Now, when you bring something to life, you talked before about fear. You know, I'm thinking of movies because the founders would have had the classics and we have movies. So when you bring something to life, sometimes you get Kelly LeBrock in Weird Science and she's wise and helpful and that's your creation, or one of these great robots that people build in films and sci-fi. And sometimes you get Frankenstein and he runs amok, you lose control over him, he destroys the village. So this really is a miracle that not only does it last for a short time, but it lasts for over 200 years. And it seems amazing that this story isn't better known, that these names that you just listed for us aren't better known. So what drew you to telling this story? Was it partially that idea that this really is an amazing accomplishment?
Well, yes, that's certainly the case. Some years ago, I wrote a book titled Washington, The Creation of the American Capital. That book is about why the city of Washington is where it is and how its founding was driven by the politics of slavery, and then how slaves actually built the federal city in its first decade. the decision to put the national capital on the Potomac was made by the first Congress. And in researching that book, I became aware of this extraordinary range of achievements of the first Congress, that it had done an amazing amount and clearly was the most successful, certainly one of the handful of most successful Congresses in American history. And I was taken aback by how little I knew about it. And I benefited happily from something called the First Federal Congress Project. That's an amazing research project that has been under the aegis of George Washington University in Washington, D.C. It's existed for about 50 years. It set out to collect and ultimately publish every record, everything written by any member of the first Congress or about the first Congress, as well as public records. And they're now clocking in at 22 volumes. It's not a very well-known project, and unfortunately, its work is not online, so it's not that easy of access. But at any rate, it was a treasure trove of the personal writings, the letters particularly, of members of the first Congress. Some of them were very, very prolific letter writers. And by going into the letters, I did get to know these men as people, with their sleeves rolled up and their jackets off, so to speak. And they became real. Some people, unfortunately, were not much in the way of letter writers. George Washington's not very good, unfortunately. He did write. He didn't have a gift for writing. And many other members, being of their time, were not all that revealing of themselves. When you come forward into the 19th century, say to the Civil War era, people are not only prolific letter writers and very literate, but they often talk about their inner selves, their feelings about things. And that's fairly rare in the 18th century and the era of the first Congress. So one of my challenges was, having read thousands of letters, to ferret out those human qualities where people express them and to try to capture the quality of mind and heart, even their relationships. Some of the most interesting letters to read were those that members wrote to their spouses. Robert Morris, the senator from Pennsylvania, is one of those. George Thatcher, a congressman from the Maine district of Massachusetts. Maine was not a state at the time, of course. Also was a man with an open heart in his letters and very, very attached to his wife. John Adams, who's not a member of the first Congress but presides over the Senate as vice president, famously had a rich correspondence with his wife, Abigail, although she's only just up the road from Federal Hall. The Adamses have rented a mansion, by the way, that stood just about where the New York City entrance to the Holland Tunnel is today. So you don't get much of a flavor of what the place was like 200 years ago.
Yeah, you say Philadelphia did a better job preserving some of these things. We have Francis Tavern, and that's about it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Left in Manhattan.
Yeah, it's frustrating. You walk lower Manhattan, and you were thwarted again and again by trying to reimagine what the world was of that first Congress. The street pattern, interestingly enough, is pretty much the same, but other than Francis Tavern and the bay itself, the water, there's really nothing that reflects what times were like then.
The reason maybe for not preserving more of the first Congress and not recognizing more of their hard work, not only what we spoke about earlier about not everyone's getting everything they want and everybody's not walking out of there thinking, wow, what an awesome job we did. I got everything for everybody back home. They do have to sell it. But also the focus of history tends to tilt towards the presidency. It tilts towards a George Washington. When you're talking about these legislators from 200 years ago, are people getting it right away? The book's been out a little while now, I guess a month. Are people understanding what you're going for? Are they as fascinated and passionate? And as a writer, do you feel that you accomplished your goal and are reaching them now about why the first Congress is so interesting?
Well, yes, I do, on both scores. I do feel that I've accomplished what I set out to do by both making clear how crucial the first Congress was to our history. Bear in mind, and I can't underscore this enough, they might have failed. There was no guarantee going into it that they were going to succeed and make this government. So this is a kind of a cliffhanger of a story. And the response to the book has been absolutely terrific. Reviews have been superb. And when I speak, and I've spoken quite a bit on the book on the East Coast and here on the West Coast, where I now live in San Francisco, and I think people feel that they're discovering a piece of history that they didn't even know existed. And one of my goals, this book has no ideological agenda whatsoever, but insofar as I had a desire for the book, it's to help show Americans today, one, how fragile and frail our government was at the start, and two, to lift up people's understanding of why the founders created the government the way they did. They made it difficult and challenging and competitive by design, in order to preclude power centering in any one individual or even in any one branch. Surprisingly enough, where there were fears of some kind of monarchical government taking hold at the beginning, it wasn't so much that people were afraid of the president, because the presidency was extremely weak. James Madison is forever looking for ways to fill the empty vessel of the presidency with some kind of power. But rather, the fear of monarchy or aristocracy, more to the point, lies in the Senate, a fear that the Senate, the senators are then elected by members of state legislatures. Many of those states have property restrictions on who can vote. So there's a fear that the Senate will become an aristocratic body. So it's counterbalanced with the power of the House of Representatives, which is a new creation, of course, by the Constitution. And I would like to think that my book will help lift, in present-day Americans' minds, lift the status of politicians. I admire politicians. I'm dismayed by the disdain that so many Americans today profess for politicians, and particularly for pragmatic politicians. I think we're paying the price for maybe one, two generations of Americans who haven't had a very good education in American history or in civics or in how government actually works, and somehow think that the founders intended it to be more efficient and presidents to be decisive and to get their way on everything. The founders didn't want the president or the senators or any single group to get its way on everything. And that may be frustrating, but it's given us an extremely stable government. I am concerned that Americans over this last generation have become so disdainful of it.
When I watch these machinations, I hear things like, well, the system is broken, the Congress is broken, they're not doing what the president wants done. Or people are saying, well, Congress isn't doing this, they're not stopping what the president wants to do, when he's maybe exercising some of his powers that are enumerated for him in the Constitution. And I always think, it's not broken, it's running exactly how it should run. We were talking before about you climbing up on that bookcase. How many lessons do we need to learn when we're small? You think this isn't working, and you start banging away at it, right? And then, you know, your mom or your dad comes and says, no, that's not how you do it. It's hard to get this to work right. I think that very much, especially reading the first Congress, I say, here's where they build this machine. And yes, it's complicated. And yes, it may seem frustrating sometimes. You just want to put a potato in at one end and get French fries out at the other end. But it brings us to something you touched on before, Theodore Sedgwick and him acting for Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton's part of the cabinet, so he's part of the executive branch, but he has Sedgwick helping to advance this agenda. Talk briefly about monetary policy, currency, the debt and credit, and how important these are, even things like what currency for us to have as Americans to make sure what you spend up in the territory of Maine is going to be worth the same down in South Carolina.
Yeah, well, one of the problems that prompted the Constitutional Convention and led to ultimately the formation of the first Congress was this country's dire financial straits, which had several different aspects. On one hand, there were more than 50 different currencies in circulation among the 13 states. More than 50. Thomas Jefferson, when he traveled from his home in Virginia up to New York City to take up his office as Secretary of State, had to change money at every state line, and he got skinned every time. This was recognized as a problem by everyone, and especially by those who wanted to build American enterprise and business. Now, the other problem, even greater, is the following. The United States was deeply, deeply in debt to lenders who had provided money during the Revolutionary War. Those lenders were primarily bankers in Amsterdam, Holland, and in France. And the United States essentially was a deadbeat nation. It was the Greece of 1789 in economic terms. the country was something like $77 million in debt, an astronomical sum in 1789. Because it was so in debt, it could not borrow any money, nor could most of the states. That debt of $77 million included both state debts and that of the national government rolled together. One of Hamilton's brilliant ideas was to do precisely that, to roll all that debt together, take it on as national debt, and then pay it off in installments. And he argued, in the end persuasively, but it was very, very difficult. He had a lot of opposition in Congress. He argued that, one, it would strengthen the national government, the central government, by taking on debt and using it as leverage. Why? Because lenders will lend more money to somebody who's good for paying it back. He wanted the United States to enjoy the support of potential lenders for when it needed money to be lent in the future. And second, it would win for the federal government support of those people it was indebted to, because they would want the federal government to succeed, precisely because if it succeeded, they would get their money back. This was very difficult to explain to men who had no education in finance or economics, in large part. Alexander Hamilton, during the Revolutionary War, when he was an aide to George Washington, to keep himself amused during that long, terrible winter at Valley Forge and other times, would sit there reading textbooks on finance from Britain. Other people were tramping back and forth, trying to keep their hands warm. He was reading finance.
I was going to say, someone must have wanted to grab him and burn him, say, put him on the fire. Let's get something warm in here.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised if that was said to him.
At the end of the first Congress, you quote a European observer predicting America will be a great power and adding the hope, quote, only let Americans be wise. Now, he's writing to future Americans, so that's all of us listening. Most of the nation's focus is on the presidential election, but all the seats in the House of Representatives and a third in the Senate will be up for re-election this November 2016. What have you learned? What advice can you give us from writing the first Congress as we go into that voting booth and we try to choose legislators that will be able to accomplish this kind of work for us?
Well, I think there are a number of lessons to be drawn. When we pull those levers, I think we should be voting for people who want to make government work. Zealots shackle the work of Congress. And there's been an overabundance of zealots and zealotry in Congress in recent years. People who regard stopping the machinery of government as a laudable achievement. Government works best when it's populated by pragmatists who are able to compromise not just the easy stuff, but to compromise when called for, even on matters of principle, in order to get something done. That's a challenge. We're in an era when such compromise is disdained. But we should go back and look at the founders and see how courageously they compromised on things that they thought they would never compromise on, whether it was Hamilton's financial plan, where to place the national capital, on the role of the federal courts, and other things. I also think that we should finally stop this condemnation of professional politicians as if they were some kind of alien species. They're us. They are ourselves. People who don't know how to make the machine work can't make it work. I'll say again that nearly all the members of that first Congress, that prodigiously productive Congress, and of the other most productive Congresses in American history, Lincoln's Civil War Congresses, the New Deal Congresses, the Great Society Congress, members were for the most part professional politicians. They were lawyers. Lawyers understand the law. They differ deeply on many issues in their time, on slavery, centralized government, regional interests, taxation, in the way that members of Congress today differ on specifics. They really wanted the government to succeed. I think we ought to look at candidates for office who want government to succeed, not who are grandstanding by proclaiming their opposition to government as if that were some kind of achievement. It's not an achievement. It's subversion of those great institutions that the founders bequeathed us.
I know I will go into the voting booth and think about these things. I am glad to know there are other people that do that, frankly. I like going in there and saying, in the long, long history of humanity, only a precious few human beings have had a chance to vote in a republic and live in a republic when you think about it. My final question is closer to home than that. I like to sometimes give authors a chance to thank the people who helped them write the book or supported them. We talked about the members of the First Congress writing their wives, getting support from the likes of Abigail Adams, who has some funny moments there in the book. You talked about drunkenness in Lower Manhattan during some of these sessions at the New Year. One person you thanked is your wife, Jean, for her, quote, seemingly inexhaustible patience with a husband whose attention is so often diverted by ghosts of the American past. So what advice do you have for spouses of a history lover? And you should probably know that you're talking for me to my wife, Kathy, because she is also very good about putting up with me living in the past. So have at it.
Well, that's a challenging question, actually. But my simple advice is just a plea to be patient, you know. I suppose I was able to get my wife to share my passion for history. And you know, a thing I said to her, but I think I said it more often to our daughter when our daughter was small and going to school. She's now 26. I said, everything has a history. Absolutely everything we know in the world that we live in has a history. And you can't really understand it fully or well until you know at least something about its history. And second, you know, I remember telling my daughter particularly that history is a story. History is full of stories. It's stories about people. It's about people like ourselves. And if you like stories, how can you not be interested in history? My wife has certainly, I think, come to enjoy and reading history as much as I do. And my daughter is currently doing a doctorate in history at Harvard. So she got the message, I think.
Did a good job. Well, thankful for daughters and wives who are patient and love history. I think that there's really no better thing to bond with somebody over and share this love. And I'm very glad that you were able to research and write the book and have her support, because I sincerely did enjoy it. I want to thank you for bringing these faces of men from the First Congress that they're never going to be on the coins in our pocket, maybe, or the dollars in our wallet, but we should know them and should remember them. It's a really great, fast-moving story, exciting. You have some great reviews at fergusbordewick.com that I would encourage people to go look at if they're considering the book. Best of luck with the First Congress, and thank you again for joining me.
Thank you, Dean. It was a great pleasure to be on.
Again, the book is The First Congress, How James Madison, George Washington, and a Group of Extraordinary Men Invented the Government. As always, you can find the Amazon link to purchase the book at historyauthor.com, and we hope you will click through there. Or if the mood strikes you, you can even bookmark the URL off the Amazon banner on our homepage. Amazon.com kicks us a small percentage of every purchase you make, and it doesn't cost you so much as a Continental. Once again, thanks to Fergus Bordewick for joining me and for helping us time travel back to those pivotal moments when the Republic was being framed. Please remember to visit him at fergusbordewick.com and let us know what you think of the book and the interview on Twitter at HistoryDean or at facebook.com/historyauthor. I hope you'll join us next time for another trip into the past here on IR Radio or wherever you're listening. And remember, if you do subscribe to us on iTunes, please leave a review. Well, that's it for this week's installment of the History Author Show. Until Classical Wisdom Wednesday, History in 5 Friday, or next Monday's interview, thanks so much for listening, and happy reading.
We still call it Broadway, but what's in a name? Take it from Georgie, it isn't the same. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore.